Hi, I'm Scott Kalbach. I'm a professor in the Political Science Department, and thanks everybody for coming today. So it's a real pleasure to have Will Piles, a professor of economics at Middlebury College, with us today. Let me put Will in a little bit of context by saying that I think one of the big lessons of the post-communist transition is the importance of institutions for economic performance, something that maybe we sort of knew, or some corners of the social sciences knew 25 years ago, but I think the transition experience has really hammered that lesson home. And I think Will has done as much as anybody to help us understand the nature of those institutions in post-communist countries and in Russia in particular. So his talk today, you can see it is on industrial land in Russia, and I have to say I'm especially pleased to see this talk today because Will gave a related talk in the spring at Harvard when I was on leave at Harvard. And the event was so poorly publicized that I had no idea that Will was even in town until I saw his note in my box after the fact. There were, what, four people at the talk or something? So it's nice to see a big turnout today for a very interesting topic. So, Will, the floor is yours. And we go until 5:30 or so? Is that?
Yes.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Scott. Should I grab the...
I can get it.
Thanks, Jennifer. Just the front one is fine, so people can see that better.
Darkness.
Well, thanks for that very kind introduction, Scott. It's wonderful to be here in Madison and on such a lovely day. As I was telling Scott and some of the grad students at lunch, I have a colleague who has an office downstairs from me and who came here to get her PhD in geography. And she said, you must have beer on the terrace. You must have beer on the terrace. And so we didn't have beer for lunch, but we had a very nice lunch on the terrace. We had milk. We had University of Wisconsin's own cows, their milk. So it was very nice. And then I had an ice cream cone on the way over to the talk. So I'm getting all sorts of dairy. The project that has been consuming a lot of my research time in the past couple years has related to land, and particularly urban land. And the paper that this is based on, this presentation is based on, in large part is co-authored work with Alexei Karas and Kuhn Schurz, with whom I've worked on a couple papers relating to banking markets, particularly depositor behavior in Russia, both pre and post the introduction of deposit insurance. And there's kind of a financial institution angle to this presentation on land. So the title of the presentation, Industrial Land, Finance and Investment in Russian Cities, loosely based on a paper called A De Soto Effect in Industry, Evidence from the Russian Federation, which I will explain the nature of that title in just a second. Okay, so the big social science-y question, let me lead with a social science question and then get into some of the motivation as somebody who's interested in Russia for the project. The big social science question is, does tenure status of land, particularly the strength of land rights, matter for firms' access to credit and also their investment activity? And so the basic hypothesis that's being tested here is, in the absence of land rights, or the absence of secure rights to land, do we see a diminished ability to use land as collateral to secure access to external loans, bank loans? Okay? And so another reason why we might also expect a relationship between the security of land rights and investment activity has to do with the expropriation threat. When the firm, if it's a private firm, doesn't own actually the land underneath it, perhaps that gives local officials, local bureaucrats, a little bit of leverage over it, and that threat of expropriation diminishes the, kind of the long-term planning of the firm, makes it a little bit less likely to invest in the firm's activities. And so this idea was picked up on in a book that probably many of you who follow the Russian situation closely familiar with. This is based on this comes from Privatizing Russia, a book co-authored by Maxime Boyko, Andrei Schleifer, and Robert Vishny. Came out in 1995, all about the Russian privatization program. And they were concerned, And I'll talk about the timeline here of privatization in the Russian context in just a second. But they were concerned that if you privatized the firm, the physical capital, the equipment and the buildings, but not the land underneath, that this could be a problem. So they say that the vagueness of lease contracts, so if the firm is still leasing land from the state, regional or local government, the vagueness of lease contracts provides officials with access to a steady flow of bribes and capacity to encourage voluntary contributions to local public goods. So it gives those public officials a little bit more leverage over the firm. The threat of maybe tearing up the lease, changing its terms, gives them then that ability to extract these voluntary contributions. And so those are the two reasons why we might expect to see a relationship between the strength of land rights, or the formalization of land rights, and investment activity. And particularly the first one, the diminished ability to use land as collateral, why we might expect to see a relationship between land rights and access to credits. And this is what we're calling the De Soto effect. Now, Hernando De Soto is a fairly well-known economist, Peruvian economist, and we see him meeting here with Putin. I think this meeting took place about 10 years ago. Hernando De Soto has become perhaps as famous as any economist in the world, even though he's not truly an academic. He's written two very well-received, widely publicized books, one called The Other Path, and then the more recent one, The Mystery of Capital. And in The Mystery of Capital, he lays out an idea that the way to the silver bullet, if you will, to solve the problems of the developing world, to solve poverty, are to extend formal land rights to people who live in urban areas. So to give people who are squatters in rural slums, like in places like Lima, Peru, or any other large city in throughout the developing world, just give them a piece of paper which says now they are formal owners of that that plot of land. Having that piece of paper will encourage them to invest in the land. It'll give them a source of wealth that they can turn into collateral to secure loans to start a new business. And then everything will kind of evolve from there. And so he's a very good marketer, very good self-promoter, and so he's been able to meet with a lot of world leaders. Bill Clinton says that he should receive the next Nobel Prize in economics. Most academic economists would probably disagree with that assessment, but he's made a big name for himself kind of promoting this thesis that better land rights will lead to better investment outcomes and better economic outcomes overall. Okay. So in terms of academic studies that test for the relationship between the strength of land rights and investment activity among economic actors, there are some that look at the strength of land rights in rural settings, and here are some authors associated with that line of research. And then there are some that have kind of followed up directly in De Soto's footsteps and tested for the relationship in urban settings. That is where there have been some of these formal land tenure programs that have followed in the spirit of what De Soto called for. Now, these sorts of settings, rural farmers and relatively poor or very poor urban households, these types of economic actors, for reasons independent of their land rights, may have very difficult times gaining access to formal sources of finance. So the fact that these sorts of studies have not found very clear relationships in support of what we're calling the De Soto effect, stronger land rights and access to formal finance on through to investment activity, may not be all that surprising. That is, we're seeing kind of mixed results from the literature that exists so far. And so the social science-y framing of this paper is that we're going to look in a slightly different setting. We're going to look in urban areas, large industrial firms, where financial market frictions we'd expect might be a little less severe, to see if there's this relationship between stronger land rights, access to credit, and investment activity. Okay. So that's the kind of the big picture of social science-y framing. Now, just a brief outline here. I'm going to talk a little bit about the motivation. And as somebody who came to economics first with an interest in Russia, My interest in this particular topic really starts as somebody who is Russianist rather than as an economist, and I'll explain that motivation. At the outset, I'll talk a little bit about the variation in regional land policy across the Russian Federation, across the territorial subjects. And then we'll look at some of the data from a survey that I collected back in the fall of 2009, and using the survey data in conjunction with regional variation in land policy across territorial subjects, try to tell a story that hopefully is somewhat convincing as to the relationships that the DeSoto effect is interested in exploring. Okay? And then finally, we'll finish up with more direct evidence from directly posed questions in the survey that seem to confirm or point in the same direction as some of the regression analysis evidence. Okay. So, about 5 years ago, I read an article by a French, let me see a French name, Alain Berthaud, and he's an urban geographer, and he's been a consultant to the World Bank now for a number of years, and he's gone around the world and collected maps of cities and trying to kind of plot out patterns in terms of how urban space is allocated. Okay? And he wrote this article that appeared in the Journal of Urban Economics comparing Paris and Moscow, Europe's two largest cities population-wise, both 10 million plus. And I found it a fascinating article, and he made some very simple points, but points that I hadn't really heard of before. Anyway, this is, I tell you right down here what it is. It's St. Petersburg. In previous iterations of this talk, I have people guess, and it kind of looks like a Kandinsky painting or something like that. But it's actually downtown St. Petersburg, and the red is industrial land. And the point that Alain Berthaud has made in a number of articles, not all of which have been published, is that the socialist development model tended to emphasize allocation of urban space to industry. Okay, when the Soviet Union got started, the Bolsheviks, they said they were representing the urban proletariat. There wasn't much of an urban proletariat to represent. And so let's urbanize, let's industrialize, let's locate industry right in the center of the city. And so a lot of cities really grew up around factories. And then once those factories were in place, you didn't have land markets to assess, well, is this use of land the optimal use? You can walk a couple blocks off of Nevsky Prospect in downtown St. Petersburg, and I believe it's still the case. It's been a couple of years since I've been there, and things are changing rapidly, we know, in the part of the world that we're interested in. But at least several years ago, you could walk a couple blocks off the main drag there and be surrounded by warehouses for coal. You know, you don't see that sort of use of urban land, very valuable urban land, in cities that have land markets, and those markets are continually assessing the value or the cost, the opportunity cost is the term that economists like to use. But St. Petersburg, 40% of the built-up land was given over to industry in the mid-1990s. That's a point that just borrowing a number from Berthaud's studies. And so to give you a kind of a comparative context for this now, so this is the share of built-up land in these various cities given over to industry. And you can see the legacy, and this is in the 1990s, the legacy of the socialist era. So here we've got Russia has got the longest legacy, roughly 70 years. St. Petersburg and Moscow, at least a third of the built-up land given over to industry. As we move further to the west, a little bit less of a history with this socialist development model, but still relatively industrialized cities. And then kind of the global norm, you have these cities here, including Paris, about 5% given over to industry. And the corollary of having industry in the center in the socialist cities is population is often at a distance from the urban core. And so the point that really Berthaud drove home in this Journal of Urban Economics piece was that if you look at the population density gradient, which is kind of an urban geography type term, that is how dense the population is relative to the center of the city, the population density gradient in most cities around the world drops. Okay, it gets less dense as you move further and further away from the center of the city. In St. Petersburg and Moscow and a number of other socialist cities, you have a relatively non-dense, whatever the opposite of dense is, sparse population in the center. And then, well, at least in the case of Moscow and St. Petersburg, you know, then there are these kind of rings of apartment buildings that went up in the 50s and 60s, and you actually had greater population densities 5 kilometers, 10 kilometers out. And most urban planners would tell you that this is not a way to organize a city. That this requires then all sorts of additional costs in terms of urban infrastructure needed to service population, which is at a distance. You need then transport networks to get people into the center where the jobs are. You also need rail lines that go into the center to service urban industry, and that disrupts the movements of peoples around the cities. And so we'd expect over time that if just market forces were allowed to operate, and of course when we're talking about urban space, it's not just market forces, even in the West, we have zoning rules, etc., all sorts of restrictions, but we'd expect to see some degree of convergence, that is, industry beginning to leave the center of these cities, and if not shutting down, at least relocating to where land values are less, and service sector type operations, residential space moving in. In fact, if we move back to, so we move back to this slide right here. So this is the Zeal factory in downtown Moscow. It's just 3 or 4 kilometers from the Kremlin, and it's a massive plot of land, and most of it's sitting unused to this day. Now, the new Moscow mayor has plans to develop it, but that won't be for some time now, and they probably turn this into a kind of residential space and shops, etc. Most of you probably know Krasny Oktyabr, the Red October chocolate factory that's been turned into kind of, it's right there in the center, right on the Moscow River. It's been turned into kind of boutique-y type shops and high-end apartments. So expect the same here. All right, scroll through this. Okay, so before I get on to talk about the data that I collected, I wanted to start with a different set of data. This is data from the Business Environment and Economic Performance Survey, which was organized and run by the European Bank for Reconstruction and Development, the help of the World Bank, if I'm not mistaken. And they went to firms across the former socialist world, and they asked them, what sorts of barriers do you face in your daily business operations? And on a scale of 1 to 5, how problematic are these issues? Okay. And so in the year 2009, if we take from that survey, and there are several hundred firms surveyed in all these countries, over 1,000 in Russia, we can see that the blue here, we've laid out the firms who say these are very problematic issues. So on a scale of 1 to 5, we're getting the percentage that said 5, big problem. So in the EU8, these are the early accession countries, the three Baltic states and Central East European countries, problems with the electricity grid dominate all the way down to business inspections. And we have just this other range here. And then the black represent the responses in Russia. Again, the percentage of firms saying a particularly egregious barrier to our daily operations. And you can see that the relationship differs between Russia and the EU countries. We don't get the similar ranking. And so what I'd like to focus on here are where does Russia seem to be a particular outlier with respect to the EU countries? What are the ones where Russian firms seem to have the most problems? So just looking at the percentage point difference, this gap right here or here, what are the three biggest? Access to land, corruption, and access to finance. So that sort of nexus of public officials being able to control land, making it more difficult for firms to access land, firms having a difficult time with land issues, therefore having a difficult time accessing finance, and this is all kind of part of the same piece with governmental corruption. Okay, so that's I was struck by what emerged in relative terms to be the most significant barriers in Russia compared to the EU. Pushing on with just a little bit more of the BEPS evidence, this again is from 2009. Firms were asked, do you have a loan currently? Okay, so in the first column, we're going to compare Russia to the EU accession countries, the EU 8. And in the second column, we're going to compare Russia to the EU 8 and former Soviet republics that were also included, so 10 former Soviet republics that also got included in the BEPS survey. And having all sorts of firm-level controls included here, all that I'm reporting is just the coefficient on the Russian dummy variable. So what's the Russian difference as relative to the EU 8 or this larger group of countries? Do firms have a loan? Well, relative to firms in the European Union, Russian firms are less likely to have a loan. They're really less likely to have a loan from a private lender. Now, conditional on having a loan at the present time, conditional on having that, these firms say that they were asked and did pledge collateral to secure that loan. Okay? So they're more likely, so that's positive there. But if collateral was pledged, so conditional on having pledged collateral, what type of asset was pledged as collateral? What we see here is that Russian firms have much less likely to have pledged land and buildings in order to secure a loan. Okay? So that would go along with a story in which land rights for firms are just much weaker. Okay? No, there's no claims about what's causing what here. This is just an interesting correlation. It's controlling for a lot of firm-specific variables. And then pushing on here, still with the BEPS, not to the survey data yet. So how about loan size? So looking at all the firms in the EU in the BEPS survey, plus the Russian firms, or all the firms from the FSU and the EU and the Russian firms, controlling for the country that you're in, country fixed effects included then, does it matter that you were pledging land and or buildings? Is it seem to be related to the characteristics of the loan? And what we see here is this is meant to show that there's a correlation between having pledged land or buildings to secure a loan and getting a larger loan. That's the dependent variable here. So firms that are getting larger loans are pledging land and or buildings. And so this goes along with a story, kind of a DeSoto type story, that commercial banks would rather have land or buildings as collateral than something else. So we saw from the previous slide that Russian firms are pledging collateral at disproportionately high rates. What type of collateral? Movable collateral. Stuff that you can actually move around. Equipment, in some cases, things that are a little bit more unusual. So this is a kind of a cute story from Bloomberg a couple years ago. A commercial bank had made a loan to a farm. The farm fell into arrears on their loans, and all of a sudden the commercial bank had to figure out what to do with the pigs that had been pledged as collateral. Banks don't want to have to deal with pigs, right? Pigs are perishable, for one, right? They'd rather not. Pigs and lingerie. Lingerie, not perishable, but lingerie maybe go out of style. Right, and also lingerie can be moved around. You can put it on a railway car and move it from city to city. And so it's not as attractive an asset as land. And so even though the financial crisis hit land values in Moscow, we get this title from the Moscow Times saying that real estate is still the preferred form of collateral, much more attractive than pigs and lingerie. What a lot of Russian firms are pledging, though, is not the pigs and lingerie. It's their physical capital. It's their equipment. And oftentimes, there aren't very liquid markets for that physical capital. Oftentimes, that physical capital is out of date. It's not kind of cutting edge. And so it's really not all that attractive an asset to have. Okay, so now we come to the kind of the historical part of the presentation. So we all know the story, or I'm assuming this is kind of a Russian studies type group. I kept seeing we all know the story, so this is right. So Russian privatization, it all happened very quickly, right? That's the standard story. It happened quickly in the early and mid-1990s, and 25,000 medium and large-scale enterprises privatized in the period of a couple of years because Yeltsin had this team around him of young economists who believed that this was the right thing to do. You need to break the power of the state. You need to get these assets in the hands of private parties as quickly as possible. Maybe it doesn't even matter exactly how it happens, as long as you just end state ownership and you get these assets into the hands of private parties. Now, when that happened, when that program went forward, the land underneath the enterprises was not included in the privatization process. And that often gets forgotten when we think back to the history of Russian industrial privatization. The land assets resided still with government, either at the local, regional, or federal level. And so you had these enterprises that have been privatized now paying rent to government, depending upon the level of the government that had owned the enterprise, federal, regional, or local. They paid the rent to the appropriate level. The Russian reformers around Yeltsin recognized, well, maybe that wasn't a good idea to divorce the land from everything else that was privatized. Maybe we should go back and revisit that. And so Yeltsin did push through some presidential decrees in the 1990s. First of all, kind of trying to encourage the regions to privatize the land that now belonged to them underneath these privatized enterprises. And of course, Yeltsin didn't have a whole lot of authority in the mid-1990s vis-a-vis the regions, and so that didn't go all that far. There were some regions that took up the call and began to privatize the land, but a number that didn't. And so Yeltsin then passed a decree in 1997 granting regions full discretion in setting land sale prices. So this goes along with Yeltsin's policy of take all the autonomy that you can swallow, right? I can't control you, so just, you guys figure it out. And so some regions were making some progress on industrial land privatization. Others, 32 regions in the mid to late 1990s passed bans on land privatization, outright bans. And Moscow was one of those. So the Moscow Duma voted for banning land privatization. And so by the end of the 1990s, only 50,000 hectares of urban land had been privatized. And just to give you a sense of how much is 50,000 hectares, that's about half the size of Moscow City, okay, so in the entire country. Okay, 50,000 hectares roughly had been transferred or sold to private enterprises across 50 territorial subjects. Now Putin comes in 2001, and I don't think it's because he met with Hernando de Soto, but his first term was relatively progressive in terms of his attitudes towards economic policy, and some things were done to change the tax code, and he also was able to push through the Duma a new land code. And the smart thing that he and his team did is that they divorced urban land from agricultural land. A big sticking point in the Duma in the 1990s in the Yeltsin era was, we're not going to privatize land if it means agricultural land. This is just not going to happen. There was a faction within the Duma, the Communist Party faction, said, no, not going to happen on our watch. So Putin's team said, okay, we're going to pass the land code. It's not going to apply to agricultural land. Just going to apply to land outside of the rural sector. And it was meant to kind of kickstart the land privatization process underneath industry, privatized industry. And so some regions, again, there was variation across regions in the extent to which they kind of followed up on this call, this push. And so by 2011, you still had a lot of firms that hadn't formally registered their land rights that as they were supposed to under the 2001 land code. Now, in 2011, there were actually three different types of ownership rights that firms could have with respect to their land. They could own it outright, private ownership. They could be leasing it from the government, generally the regional government, or they could have that land under the old Soviet form of land tenure, which the loose translation is perpetual or permanent use. And that is probably the weakest form of land tenure. It gives the government that owns the land very strong eminent domain rights. They can go in and seize the land if they want to, as long legally as they kind of compensate the firm for it. At least the lease has a specific period of time in which the firm has very clearly delineated user rights over the land. So three different types of land as of 2011. The dates by which the Soviet form of land tenure was supposed to be wiped out kept getting pushed back. Initially it was 2004, then it was 2006, then 2008. Finally it was January 1st, 2012. Business lobby said, we still got all these firms out there that haven't formally changed from the Soviet form of land tenure. Give us a little bit more time, and so it was pushed back to July 1st, 2012. I think everything was supposed to have taken place by July 1st, 2012. I haven't checked the papers recently to figure out if there's still some stragglers, still some firms that hold their land under the former Soviet land tenure. But one of the inducements for re-registering your land was that you could buy it if you wanted to at a discounted price relative to the cadastral value. So they sent all these kind of surveyors out across Russian space to cities and tried to come up with kind of estimated values of the land underneath these enterprises. And before July 1st, 2012, you, as an enterprise that wanted to purchase the land, you could still purchase it at a fraction of the cadastral value. So in most cities, this was about 3% of the cadastral value, so relatively cheap if you bought the cadastral valuation. In Moscow and St. Petersburg, it was 20%. And so my sense was that this encouraged a lot of purchase in just the past year or so since we actually did the survey. Scott.
So you said that, so this is mostly, the land is mostly owned by regional governments, not by the municipalities.
Yeah, I can't get a good breakdown on that, but my sense is there's a fair amount of anecdotal evidence, also evidence from the firms, because we asked the firms, if it's state-owned land, where do you pay your rent to? And most are saying they're regional governments, but in some cases it is the municipalities, in some cases it's the federal government. Yeah. So I really like this diagram right here. It's capturing urban land held privately by firms in thousands of hectares. And so when the land code is passed, we have just these 50,000 hectares that have been privatized. So that was based upon what had happened during the Yeltsin era. Then we got the land code passed. We can see the 2000s are actually a decade of asset privatization in Russia. And the standard story of Russian privatization is that privatization stalled, perhaps was even reversed in the 2000s, and it was the 1990s that were the decade of big privatization. At least with respect to urban land, it's kind of the opposite. The real story is in the 2000s. So we get about 18% growth per year in the stock of land that's held privately in cities by firms. Yeah?
That's the total amount that's been privatized, though?
Yes.
So if 50,000 is one half of Moscow, that's like three Moscows for the whole country.
That's right. Yeah.
It's still pretty...
It's still relatively small, but it's a share of urban, as a share of industrial land. So within Moscow, say, and Moscow is a heavily industrialized city, about a quarter of Moscow space is industrial area. So there's a lot of land that, you know, it's park space, it's Mileva, it's, you know, it's...
But this is for the whole country.
This is for the whole country, yeah. And so Medvedev just gave an interview where he said we still need to go faster on land privatization. Right, it's still lagging. Yeah, it's still a relatively small amount of land.
Could you express that as a percentage? So what percent of all urban land was privately held by firms by 2010?
I think I could, but I can't distinguish urban land. It's like Russian law divides land up into seven different categories. There's like water and forestry and heritage land. So there's some lands within urban areas that are not going to be privatized ever.
Or percent of all industrial land.
Yeah, so I can't do that. I just don't have the data to do that. But I'll talk a little bit more about the regional variation in just a second here. So this is what the regional variation looks like right now. So in 2008, Roskadastr, which is a Russian government agency in charge of kind of tracking the progress of the real estate cadastre, the surveying of Russian land across space, published the stock of land, data on the stock of land in population centers, it's Naselenie Punkty, that is industrial, commercial, or residential, that's held by firms. And then they also had the land that's held by the state. Okay, and so this allows us to create a ratio of land held by private firms relative to the land held by the state and see how that ratio varies across space in Russia here. And so the white areas we don't have data for. But all the other areas, we can see that there's a fair amount of variation and not necessarily a clear regional pattern.
So we read this as, in the most privatized regions, 25 times as much land was owned by firms as this was owned by...
Okay, that's right. How do we read this? So this means that... actually, this is a percentage. And so the numerator is 4 times smaller than the denominator. And so in a place like Belgorod, which is our leader here, if we think of the land owned by the state is 4 times the amount of the land owned by firms, so 1/4. Okay. And so here's the regional variation expressed in another way. These are the regions for which I have enterprise survey data, and so we have also the number of firms surveyed in each of these regions. You can pick out your favorite territorial subject. Here we see Moscow City all the way down at the end. Very little private land in Moscow as of January 1st, 2008. It's probably not a coincidence that the former mayor's wife became the most wealthy woman, the wealthiest woman in Moscow. She had headed up a real estate development firm. If you had any sort of real estate development project, you went to the mayor's office. The mayor's office referred you to the mayor's wife. She controlled access to who got, you know, access to what land, all determined through the mayor's office, and became very wealthy in the process. You see, there's some kind of interesting stories here. I'd like to know more about kind of why Tatarstan is one of the leaders in this respect. Yeah.
But this is for the whole region, right?
These are in cities. This is within Naselenie Punkty. So this is within population centers.
But all of the population centers for a given region.
All the population centers for a given region. Okay. Yes. Yes. Okay. All right. So I've got this variation across space just for one point in time. That's the nature of the data. It was put up on the Roskadastr site. Roskadastr was subsumed by a new government agency now called Rosreestr, the Russian registry. And they are not as generous in terms of publishing this sort of regional data. And so, unfortunately, just got kind of one crack at this variable that allows us to assess regional variation. Okay, so before proceeding here, I want to lay out what's my mental model, heuristic model, and thinking about the behavior of firms and whether or not tenure status, land tenure status, matters for firms. So we have federal land initiatives that are a function of national politics, and then regions respond to those federal initiatives based upon political and economic characteristics and the variation therein, and set an average price for a unit of land, okay, based upon whatever those characteristics that drive whether or not they're receptive or more receptive or less receptive to the federal land initiatives. And they set this average per unit price on land, and then firms make a decision about whether or not they want to actually privatize their land. Now, when I say the price that the regional governments are setting, I'm thinking about price in both an explicit sense, that is, the actual monetary amount that they're paying, but also the implicit price, because regional governments can make the process of actually privatizing, taking ownership of your land plot, more or less difficult. They can set up all sorts of bureaucratic barriers, red tape, etc., just make life very difficult for the firms. The firms then react to that price, both the explicit and implicit component, and decide whether or not to privatize their land. And then that decision will impact, or may impact, that remains to be tested here, their access to credit and their investment activity. So that's kind of the mental model. The survey is going to allow us to focus on this component right here. This relationship right here, how regions actually arrive at their land policies, is an interesting question that I'm hoping to address in a later paper, but it's not one that we're focusing on right now.
It seems like, so if you're going to be using firm-level data to estimate the relationship between tenure status and credit access and investment, then potentially there's an issue here that firms are selecting into.
Yes. Yeah. And so we're going to try to kind of address that.
Yeah.
Okay. So let's talk about the survey a little bit. So this is a survey that went to the field in the fall of 2009. There are 359 industrial enterprises that participated. I worked with the Levada Analytical Center in carrying out the survey across a number of cities. Moscow and St. Petersburg are heavily represented. About a fifth of the observations come from Russia's two largest cities. About half the observations come from what we're calling, with respect to land, progressive regions. That is, they're in the top third of that earlier chart, that is, the high ratios in terms of land privatization. All of the respondents have roots in the old regime. That is, they were Soviet enterprises. They were state-owned at one point. All of them had been established before 1986, and all of them had at least 500 employees. This was a filtering criterion. At least 500 employees in 2007. The idea here was to get enterprises that had a lot of employees, because we didn't have information on who has a lot of land. Nobody had that information. And so in some sense, number of employees, we're figuring that's correlated with land intensity. Okay. So the sectoral distribution, these are all sectors within industry. Food processing, chemicals, building materials are the most heavily represented within the survey. Okay. The types of questions that were asked in the survey, it took about an hour for the full survey to be completed. Kind of standard firm survey questions, employment, ownership structure, who your trade partners are, these sorts of things. And then a lot of questions dealing with their primary production plot. That is, the piece of land where most of their economic activity is taking place. And some of these firms have a lot of plots. When I was beginning to think about the design of the survey, I went and visited an optics manufacturer in St. Petersburg that had 40 plots around St. Petersburg. And they had actually taken the opportunity to privatize their land in the 1990s, and now they were renting out some shops to banks, supermarkets, as they were downsizing their own production. Their workforce had been more than cut in half. They'd gone from like 20,000 down to 2,000, and they were making actually a lot of money off of their leases. So then there were questions about three additional plots beyond the primary production plot, and questions about possible involvement with the sales or seizures, government seizures of plots that may have been attached to the firm previously. And then finally, kind of a set of questions that put the manager in the position of being an expert on land issues and asking them about their thoughts about the progress, about progress relating to land policy. But we're going to focus, for the sake of this presentation, on these two categories of questions right here. Okay. So here are the dependent variables. This is what I'm trying to explain and understand at the firm level. So firms were all asked the degree to which you have difficulties accessing credit. And so they were actually, in much the same way that we saw with the BEEPS survey, questions about the barriers to your daily business operations, I asked in this survey, again on a 1 to 5 scale, to what extent are the following issues problematic? Are they, do they create difficulties for your firm? And so 5 means very problematic. And so we're dividing up respondents here by the tenure status of their primary production plot. So some of the firms, it's roughly about half the firms in the survey, own their primary production plot privately. About a third of the firms lease their plot, and then the remainder hold their plot under this Soviet form of tenure here. And so we can see that there is kind of an unconditional correlation between access to credit being a problem and land tenure status here. Those with perpetual use rights have the most problems accessing credit. Okay, those with private rights have the least. The second dependent variable is the intensity of investment activity. So firms were asked, it's a relatively coarse, actually very coarse measure of investment intensity in the year of the survey. So on a scale of 1 to 5, how intense was your investment program in the past, in this year? 5 being a very intense investment program. We're investing in our plants, capital equipment to a great extent. And again, we're seeing an unconditional correlation between tenure status and investment activity. The firms that own their land privately report higher on this 1 to 5 scale, higher levels or more intense investment than those that own or that hold their land under perpetual use rights, the Soviet form of land tenure. Okay, so I want to talk a little bit about here how we're going to go from kind of these unconditional correlations to a more, hopefully more convincing story about a causal relationship between tenure status and those two dependent variables. And so thinking simply of kind of the model that we're going to be estimating here, our dependent variable can either be that to what extent is access to credit a problem for your firm, 1 to 5, 5 being most problematic, or it can be how intense was your investment activity in 2009, 5 being very intense. And the variable, the primary variable of interest, this T here, is going to be the tenure status of your primary production plot. Do you own it privately? Do you lease it? Or do you hold it under perpetual use rights? And then we're going to have a wave of controls that we're going to have enter in mini waves. Across several specifications. And so what sorts of controls are we going to look at? So first of all, the baseline controls, we're going to full-time employees, years since your firm, not the land, was privatized, the city size, and then an index of other barriers that you may have confronted. And those other barriers that get thrown in there are, do you have problems with corruption? Do you feel overly burdened in terms of non-land related taxes? Are you experiencing problems with overdue payments? There's one more that I'm blanking on.
Those seem pretty endogenous. I mean, you're going to have more problems with overdue payments if you can't get credit, perhaps.
Let me push on a little bit, and then let's come back to kind of issues of endogeneity and problems in identification strategies, etc. Okay, so plot characteristics, and so we have data from the survey on various characteristics of the plot. Where is it located in the city? Are there other enterprises close by? I'll show all of them in just a second here. Ownership structure, so we have various controls for who plays an important role in setting the strategic direction of the firm. Do foreigners have any role? Does the labor collective have any role? Are you a member of a commercial group, a financial industrial group? There is some evidence from previous research that members of financial industrial groups have easier access to credit. We're going to have a measure of firm profitability or performance in here. It's a very coarse measure. It's going to be scaled 2 to 6 based upon how profitable you were in 2007 and 2008, where a response in 2007 is on a scale of 1 to 3, 3 being very profitable, down to 1. We've lost money. And then we summed up over 2007 and 2008. Then we're going to also include in another wave regional characteristics that we feel might also be related to land policy and things like credit access and investment intensity. And so we're going to include a measure here of growth in loans in the region and also various measures of policy in the region, regional economic liberalization and corruption. And these come from the Carnegie Center's index of experts. They come up with this index. It's almost on an annual basis, I think. And these numbers come from, I believe, 2005. We're also going to have some specifications that control for the sector that the firms are in. And then we're going to have some specifications that control for the region, include regional fixed effects. And so we'll drop the regional characteristics in those specifications in which we include the regional fixed effects. And then we move beyond that, addressing kind of the potential endogeneity of tenure status to our dependent variables here by trying to instrument for tenure status using the regional land policy index. That is what we saw in the previous slides where Belgrade was at the top and Moscow city was at the bottom. And I'll explain a bit more detail exactly about that when we get to it. Okay, so we're going to address the potential endogeneity of land tenure here. And here we go to the actual controls that are included. Okay, so we've got measures of employment, years since privatization, okay, various ownership controls in here, measure of profitability. We've got these plot characteristics here. Is the plot the only one attached to the enterprise when the enterprise was privatized? We've got a measure of whether or not this plot has been designated as environmentally hazardous. We can see that roughly 5% of the plots that we're considering here have been given this designation as the most hazardous. Like these are like the chemical firms that, you know, have a tough time cleaning up their land. We'd expect maybe land values and therefore value as collateral to be connected to location within the urban environment. And so if you're located on the edge of the city, we can see here about half the firms are located on the edge of the city as opposed to in the historic center or the right in the heart of the city. And then also another plot characteristic about whether there are other firms close by, thinking that maybe some firms might have property disputes with other enterprises close by, and that may make their land a little bit less desirable in terms of its collateral value. Okay, so I don't want to spend a lot of time on this. There's charts with a lot of data here. For those of you who are interested in kind of the model that we're using, this is an ordered probit. So we've got an ordered variable on the left-hand side, dependent variable, can take the value from 1 to 5. Okay, and so what we're going to do is run the same sort of model, ordered probit model, on the dependent variable access to credit, where a higher score on the access to credit means more problems accessing credit. And what we're going to do is progressively enter in more and more types of controls as we go from left to right here. The difference between the first column and the second column is in the first column we're comparing firms that own their land privately to firms that own their land that hold their land under the two other categories. Okay? And in the second column, we're comparing firms that own, that lease their land and firms that hold their land under perpetual use to the omitted category here, which is firms that own their land. Okay? And so we're interested in the relationship there between these non-private tenure status categories and access to credit as well. But we're going to drop that consideration and then start just adding all these controls down here. Okay? So where I'd want to focus your attention is what's happening up here with a private, we can see across the top row that there's a relatively strong, relatively robust correlation between owning the plot privately, a negative correlation, and experiencing problems in accessing credit. Yeah.
So might not a skeptic look at this and say, based on the second model results, that the real effect is a contrast between the Soviet style, perpetual use, and other, as
yeah.
opposed to private versus leasing.
Yes.
And doesn't the property rights argument really turn on owning versus renting more than Soviet style versus
right.
non-Soviet style?
So yeah, so what you're highlighting there is we're getting statistical significance here on this variable, not on this variable. But at least we're getting a positive sign here. And if you buy my story that there's a spectrum of rights, from weakest to strongest, from Soviet tenure to leasing to private ownership, then this, at least the magnitudes of these coefficients are consistent with that story.
But the difference between private and lease is about the same as the difference between lease and perpetual use. Right. I mean, the reason you've got significance on perpetual use is it's just the larger of the two coefficients relative to the basic.
That's right. Yeah. So yeah, this number is double this number.
These are like, think of these as like ordered categories. It's like
yeah.
the same effect going from step one to step two is from going from step two to step three.
Right. But compared to lease firms compared to private firms, at least in this specification here, there's no statistically significant difference in terms of their access to credit. We're going to see in some of the other models.
There's no significant difference between perpetual use and lease either.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh, I haven't tested that.
Yeah.
And so that's something that I could test. So perpetual use, we do see that. Yeah, so we'll see this type of model, but with a different dependent variable in just a second here, and we get a little bit different result. But you're right. Is the story I want to tell just about private property rights, or is it about stronger property rights? If it's a story more about stronger property rights, then clearly this is not as strong compared to this, and we're getting a statistically significant relationship in comparing those two groups, at least. So, but where I really want to focus attention is on this top row and this kind of a robust relationship. Even when we start adding in these other controls down here, even when we add in regional fixed effects in the last specification, we're getting strong kind of conditional correlations between tenure status and access to credit. Some nice results here that come through in kind of an expected way. Firms that are members of commercial groups, in line with previous research, a lot of these big financial and industrial groups, they do include banks as part of them, and so they tend to have less trouble in accessing credit. And so that's a reassuring result right there. Okay, so now we're going to change the dependent variable and do the exact same thing. Now the dependent variable is investment intensity in 2009, and so we can see here that a strong relationship between private tenure status and investment intensity until we get to this final column and we add in the regional fixed effects. And it's the regional fixed effects which kill the statistical significance there. But everything up until that point, even including the regional characteristics, we've still got a pretty strong relationship, significant at the 5% level. And if we go back to what you were focusing on earlier, we see here weakest tenure rights, kind of the least intense investment activity, a little bit stronger rights compared to perpetual use, but still compared to the private, less intense investment activity. Yeah?
Is there any reason why profitability does not have any effect in the previous slide, but is really...
Yeah, so here we can think of profitable firms, they can draw on their own resources to fund investment. So this is again a kind of a reassuring result. Firms that are making profits, they have retained earnings that they can plow back into investment activity. But you're right, we didn't see that in the previous slide. I don't have a good story for why we're not picking up profitability. We would think maybe external lenders would be sensitive to firm's financial success in previous years, but we're not seeing any strong relationship.
What could be
offsetting. I mean, maybe it's not a problem for them. Maybe they could get it if they wanted to, but they don't consider it a severe problem because they have their own resources.
Yeah, so that's the kind of the story I'm telling here is that this is picking up the supply side of credit. And now the story that you're telling is, well, maybe this is kind of profitability is picking up kind of the demand for credit here. That's possible. That's possible. Yeah. Okay. So I want to come back to this model now. So all I've been able to do so far is show these conditional correlations between tenure status and credit access and investment intensity. Okay, so it's possible that the relationship that we're picking up there between the firm's plot status and its credit access and investment intensity is being driven by some unobserved variable at the firm level, right? Something we just can't observe that's impacting both its tenure status of its plot and its access to credit and investment intensity, okay? Or you can imagine maybe that omitted variable is explaining credit access, and then credit access then determines the ability to purchase your plot. That sort of thing. You can imagine all sorts of stories. And so to take into consideration or try to respond to those sorts of stories here, we're going to come up with an instrumenting strategy. That is, we're going to use the region-level variation in land policy to predict whether or not the firm is going to have a private or a non-private land plot, and then take that predicted value in a second stage regression to explain access to credit and investment intensity. So that's where, coming back to this model comes in. We can imagine these regions setting an average price, okay, for the land underneath, setting policy based upon various regional characteristics. That right now I'm not able to explain all that well. What are those regional characteristics that are driving the variation in regional land policy? Okay. So we can imagine regions setting different prices, thinking of that price being both the explicit and the implicit portion, and then firms are going to respond to it. So you might be in a region, in a sense, accidentally. You're there, okay? You're in that region. The policy is made, and now it's either more or less difficult to privatize your plot based upon that regional price. So then you decide whether or not to privatize your plot. And not all firms in the most liberal regions have privatized. We get a lot of variation within given cities in terms of plot tenure status. Okay, so there's variation across regions, and even within regions or within individual cities, we have some firms that own their plot and some firms that don't own their plot. And then that tenure status may in turn determine access to credit. Now, remember, this sort of story presumes, this strategy presumes that firms are responding, making their privatization decision, after the policy has been set, right? Now remember, my regional policy variable is based upon what time? It's based upon January 1st, 2008. And we know that a lot of firms privatized their plots prior to January 1st, 2008. So it's incumbent upon us to actually convince you that the regional variation in land ownership in 2008 is also similar to the pattern of variation in prior periods, right? And so if we think now about when land was actually privatized, these are the firms in the survey who say they have their own, they own their plot privately. When did they privatize their plot? Well, the enterprises were privatized in the dark years here. So over 50% of the enterprises in the survey privatized their plot. And these are the firms. So this is just the firms who have their plot under private ownership. When were the enterprises themselves privatized? Over 50% before 1994 and before. And then a few stragglers were privatized in later years. How about the land underneath? Well, there were some plots that got privatized before 1994, but we have then plots of these surveyed firms privatized all the way up until almost the date of the survey. Okay, and so remember, our measure of regional land variation is from 2008, right? But I have to be able to show you, I have to be able to argue that it's also capturing something about policy environments prior to that, And so that's what the next slide's going to attempt to do, that the variation from 2008 is also very similar to the variation in land policy prior to that, at least in terms of the regional patterns. And so here we're looking at just firms that have privatized their plots. They were asked, did you experience any problems in privatizing your plot? And then given a list of different things that might have caused difficulty. And one of those difficulties was outright opposition from local officials. Okay, so regardless of when you privatized, what type of difficulties did you experience? And so that was on that variable was on a 1 to 5 scale. Seems like everything in my survey is on a 1 to 5 scale. Right, on a 1 to 5 scale, so 5 being very, we experience a lot of problems privatizing the plot. And so if you buy my story about the 2008 stock data capturing regional variation, not only in 2008, but prior to 2008, then it should be the case that firms, even if they privatized their plots in the 1990s, difficulties experienced therein should be correlated to this 2008 measure I have for land privatization. And that's exactly what this upper row is showing. If we take all the firms that have privatized their plot before 2005, that's two-thirds of the firms. So the two-thirds are early ones. So that's 105 firms. We can see that there's a strong relationship between this measure of land policy and experiencing opposition of local officials. If we take the two-thirds, the later group, those that privatized their plot after 2000, which is also two-thirds of the firms that are privatized, so roughly the same number here, we can see there's also a strong relationship. So the argument I'm making here is that this index that comes from 2008 does a good job of explaining regional opposition, regional official opposition to land privatization policy across a broad spectrum of time. Okay. Because the strategy, the empirical strategy, is premised upon kind of this notion that firms are responding to what's happened in terms of regional policy when they make their privatization, their plot privatization decisions. Okay. So this slide is capturing this instrumental variable approach where we're now going to predict the firm's plot status with the regional land stock data from 2008, which we're saying measures or captures policy variation across space. So the first stage, we've got all these right-hand side controls, including that land policy index, the urban, commercial, residential, industrial land owned by firms relative to land owned by states. So in Belgrade, we saw it was 24.9. In Moscow, we saw it was 0.2. So we're using that variable to predict the firm's own plot status. Then we take that predicted value for the firm's own plot status and put it into the second stage and then look at the relationship with accessing credit. And what we see here is that when we try to address the endogeneity problems associated with land tenure of the firms, the plot tenure status of the firm, and access to credit and investment activity, through this strategy, the results hold up nicely.
They're much bigger, aren't they?
Well, I'm not sure if we can make that direct comparison. So these were ordered probit models earlier, and
now this is just one year.
So. This is not a canned program in Stata, because we've got an endogenous regressor that's binary, right? Do you own your plot privately or not? And we've got a left-hand side variable of interest that's an ordered variable. Stata doesn't have a package for that. And so this is an instrumental variable package that's meant to handle situations where you have binary endogenous regressors and ordered left-hand side variables. And it's like ordered probit, but it's not quite the same thing. And so,
be interesting is to compare the coefficients, just running the original model,
yeah,
just linear model.
Just linear, yeah, okay. So, but we can't. I don't think we can directly compare coefficients because this is like one of these glam wrapper programs that downloaded. And honestly, I'm kind of fuzzy on all that. But we cite a state journal paper, and you know,
they run forever.
What's that?
They
take a long time. They take a long time. Yeah. So the results hold up nicely there in the access to credit regressions. They hold up nicely in the investment intensity regressions.
But now, earlier you weren't getting significant results when you had regional fixed effects, and here you can't have region fixed effects because your instrument is just a
That's right.
section of regions.
That's right. Okay,
so really, I mean, it's possible. Yeah.
It was the one column where we didn't get right statistical
right.
significance.
Yeah.
But we are controlling for regional characteristics here.
Yeah.
Five or six. Regional characteristics. Okay, so we like this. We kind of like these results here. And then I'm running out of time. There are a couple of robustness checks here where we address possible reverse causality type stories. In these slides, not a lot that I want to touch on there. But I want to get to this direct evidence. Generally, this type of evidence tends to be brushed aside in a lot of in journal type settings. Just asking firms, is this important? Is this why you did something? So how often do banks require pledge of land as collateral to secure long-term credit? It's a very simple question. And so roughly 40% of the firms are saying, yeah, this happens to a great extent, but it's not universal. We get 20% of firms saying, no, this isn't an issue. That banks don't ask for land as collateral to secure credit. And then another one, your motives, firms that privatize their plots, why did you do it? Simple, again, very straightforward question. And it's nice in the sense that we are getting some non-trivial percentage of the firms that are saying on a scale of 1 to 5, like everything else in the survey, right? 5, yes, this is a very important motive for privatizing our plot. Increased access to credit. But also we're seeing just kind of these increased, more secure property rights type stories. So I like to think that this kind of supplements another type of evidence that kind of tells the same story or points in the same direction. So that's basically it. We'll finish with the pigs, just another shot of the pigs. Why we don't want pigs.
Update one. I'm curious what it is. What was the book?
I don't know. Yeah. Oh, no. Yes. Oh, no. The pigs have died. Yeah. I'm not sure. So I don't know if you all have questions. Or... Yeah.
Well, I mean...